This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Isabella Pinaway with you for the Country Hour this Monday. I hope you got some wet stuff on the weekend. Coming up, we'll find out why demand for Australian timber is falling.
We are seeing that China is moving more to the west, away from the east coast, in terms of construction. The government is pushing construction to the west. So what's happening there is Russian log and Russian lumber can actually access the west at cheaper rates than we would traditionally could from the east coast via exports.
And an animal welfare group says the federal government's new trespass bill is threatening their right to take action against animal cruelty on farms. We'll delve into that story after the weather. But first today, and is the Murray-Darling Basin plan delivering for taxpayers? That's the question behind tonight's Four Corners investigation. It's found more than $4 billion in Commonwealth funds have been granted to irrigators to improve their businesses. One of the reporters from tonight's program is Sean Rubenstein Dunlop.
In many cases, tens of millions of dollars are being handed under this scheme to big business, to huge corporations, some of them partly foreign-owned, to carry out big, big business expansions.
Okay, big business is the big winner. You're saying that the grants have been handed to the irrigators, but wasn't that the whole point of the Murray-Darling Basin plan? In exchange for water savings and for water to be returned to the environment, there would be incentives.
That's absolutely right. This is the purpose of the scheme, and the aim was for it to be a win for farming communities who could reap the benefits of grants for infrastructure and a win for the environment with water being recovered for the river system.
Which we have actually seen. There's a significant amount of water which has gone to the Commonwealth Environment Waterholder, and you're going to speak to one of the former heads of the CHU on the program tonight, David Papps. So have you found that the scheme is not unfolding legally or as it was bound to?
It's unfolding according to the law, judging by everything we've discovered. The issue is that it's incentivizing farmers to use more water, not less, and that wasn't the intent of the plan. Taxpayers were told this was a win-win for farming communities and for the environment. We've seen several cases where farming communities aren't getting the benefits they could have out of these billions of dollars in spending. And we're seeing that, in fact, more water could be being taken from the river under this scheme. All legal. It's all legal, but the question is, are taxpayers getting what they paid for? And we spoke to a lot of farmers in southwest New South Wales. Our focus was on the Murrumbidgee Valley, which is the most productive valley in Australia. It's a food bowl.
And when it's has water.
That's right. And it's where a lot of big corporations backed by foreign interests have been moving in the past decade, and they have been able to use this scheme to get access to more water. And the farmers we spoke with who had benefited in some ways from this scheme, they'd received hundreds of thousands of dollars to pay for water-saving infrastructure and to make their farms more productive. They had problems with this scheme as well. They said that the government was paying vastly overinflated prices for the water it was buying back. They said that there was so little oversight that some people could take full advantage and profit from the lucrative grants using some of the money that it may not have been intended for. They said that the grants were paying them to carry out work that they would have paid for anyway, which some who we spoke to said was poor use of taxpayer money. And, most importantly, they said that the government isn't monitoring whether the estimated water savings are actually taking place.
Sean Rubenstein Dunlop, we're having a chat about Four Corners tonight, and I know you're under the pump, but a couple more questions for you.
No worries.
Who are those that you've discussed this poor return on public investment? Who are they pointing the finger at, given this was a bipartisan agreement signed up to by several states? And of course, the federal government with bipartisan support. Where are they laying the blame on this one?
We spoke with really high-profile farmers like Glenn and Julie Andriazza, the New South Wales Farmers of the Year, or Kelvin and Glenn Baxter, who have a big farming business in the Murray. And they're pointing the finger at the design of the scheme itself. It's about a policy which is incentivising farmers to use more water, but to also return water, which in some cases these farmers regretted having handed over. So it's about the way the scheme was designed in the first place to pervert the intent of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan.
Having a look at social media over the weekend, there's a few irrigators who seem to be on the offensive already, quite concerned about the way that tonight's program might portray farming across the Murray-Darling Basin. Have you been surprised by that? And do farmers have anything to fear by tonight's program?
Look, I haven't been surprised by that. Water is such an emotive issue, and justifiably so. It's the lifeblood of our nation. It's the lifeblood of our farming communities. And so, of course, a program which some might fear would put that under threat is gonna raise alarm. But I just want to say that we have spoken to numerous farmers in the Murray-Darling Basin, and we have put their concerns out there for all to see. It's farmers themselves who are criticising this scheme. And so I think that any Australian taxpayer would be hoping for transparency and accountability in the way their money is spent, and particularly when the money has been spent in this way with the aim of benefiting particular communities.
That's Sean Rubenstein Dunlop, who's one of the reporters behind tonight's Four Corners program. He was speaking there with Kath Sullivan, and you can see the report in full on ABC TV tonight at 8:30. You can also share your initial thoughts on this story with us right now on 0467 922 783. And while we are speaking of water, if you got some rainfall over the weekend, we'd love to know. You can let us know by texting 0467 922 783. Well, an Australian timber exporter says the industry is feeling the effects of some major international changes. Paul Hubenoff, CEO of Pentark Forestry, says China is importing cheaper Russian timber for its construction in the country's west, and that's shifting the international market. He says it's just one reason for a softening demand for both softwood and hardwood.
Export market is in a difficult place at the moment. We've seen big price corrections, especially in the softwood market. More recently, we've seen the hardwood market drop away pretty quickly as well.
What's driving these drop-offs?
They're two different markets. So the softwood market, what we're seeing in China is there's about 4.5 million cubic metres of stock in that market. Traditionally, we're moving into warm summer months in China, so lower consumption, lower construction and all that type of stuff. So traditionally it does drop off a little bit, but not as quickly as this. We are seeing that China is moving more to the west, away from the east coast, in terms of construction. The government is pushing construction to the west. So what's happening there is Russian log and Russian lumber can actually access the west at cheaper rates than we would traditionally could from the east coast via exports. So we're seeing a big correction on that basis.
Do you expect that to be long term?
I think at the moment we're seeing that as a step change. Traditionally, we've had blips in the market and the market's come back, but we're seeing this as a bit of a step change, and we're seeing it probably that the market could stay lose fundamentally about 10 to 15 US dollars per cubic meter.
The dollar's a bit low at the moment. Is that helping you at all?
Oh, it always helps exporters because that makes us more competitive. But what we're seeing counter to that is freight markets we think are going to move dramatically with low sulfur fuel issues that come in from 1 January next year.
Can you briefly run through that?
So all ships from 1 January have to burn low sulfur fuel. So in the past, there were certain zones that they had to do that. Now, because of the IMO regulations, vessels have to burn low sulfur fuel no matter where they're trading in the world. So what that means is the cheaper fuel no longer is workable for vessels. They've got to actually buy a more expensive fuel that is low sulfur.
And how's that going to impact your markets?
Well, we expect that freight will jump in the region of 15% to 20%, mainly in the short term because vessels have to actually be retrofitted or they actually have to go and clean their tanks. So there'll be vessels that get pulled out of the market, but also they're going to be using a higher cost fuel to get to market. So overall, we think the impact 15% to 20% on current freight rates will be the increase.
What about the China-US trade war? How's that impacting?
A lot of what that's doing is taking sentiment out of the market. So there's little confidence in the market. So people, rather than being confident to buy logs, they're now saying, well, we've got no real confidence to buy anymore. So there's a price issue. So price is corrected to some extent. But customers are also saying to us they've got no real confidence to be buying going forward. So we've got sentiment and pricing issues happening at the moment.
How long do you expect that to last?
What I said about the price is a step change because of other competition, so European and Russian lumber coming in to compete, so step change there. But I think sentiment is very hard to tell because if you see a price correction of $20 in the market on a stock sitting there, 4.5 million, people have lost $80 to $90 million. They're going to take some time to actually recover that money. So it does take at least 6 months to get over such issues.
We're speaking a lot about China. Where are the other big markets?
China is the biggest market for solid wood. It takes probably 60 to 80% of the production. So it is China. Everything else revolves around China. So what happens in China just moves to other markets. So if there's a correction in China, India will react the same way. Korea will react the same way. They all watch China. So China is it, basically. You talk China and everything else reacts to that.
Anything else you'd like to add on markets at the moment?
Yeah, look, we always see this. We've been in the game for 25 years or longer, and we've seen these movements before. The market comes back. There's a fibre requirement in the market, so we don't think it's always going to be depressed. There's going to be times again where it'll pick up. It depends a lot on consumption and consumption patterns. So if everything keeps moving towards the west, we think softwood will stay pretty low. But the hardwood market, I think, has got a lot more upside to it. We think that'll bounce back quicker.
That's Paul Hubenough, CEO of Pentark Forestry, speaking there to Hugh Hogan. A few of your rainfall texts coming through to 0467 922 783. Both anonymous, feel free to pop your name on the ends of them if you'd like to. Stirling North, 6 millimetres, and then up at Boobarawi, there's 1.4 millimetres. So it's better than a kick in the teeth. You can let me know how much rain you've had, or you can share your thoughts on federal funding going to water infrastructure projects, which is the focus of tonight's Four Corners story. 0467 922 783. A new online map that's just been released can show regular updates of how crops are developing and what is planted where, thanks to new satellite technology. Monash University researchers say the map, which only covers Victoria so far, can help things like planning for bushfires, as well as crop types and expected yields, and it could be expanded nationwide. Nicolas Balhart spoke with Francois Petitjean from Monash.
The technology now, the satellite technology, is really mature. And so it's been 2 years that we're working on this project. And the idea was to create a map of Victorian vegetation at a resolution that hadn't been done before. So the resolution is just the size of the pixels in the map, if you want. So we managed to get down to 10 meter resolution. So each little pixel is 10 by 10 meter. And we look at the evolution of the vegetation through the year, and we assign a color which is a type of vegetation to each pixel. So for example, if you go and see the map, so you can access it to on monash.edu/it/vegmap, V-E-G-M-A-P. You'll see, for example, that around Shepparton, you have a lot of, so Shepparton is in pink, and you have a lot of areas that are purple. Purple is for vines, basically. But you also see the canola crops in yellow around it, etc. And so we've done that for the whole state.
And so what's the significance of being able to determine what crops are coming and going? Why is that important?
Well, it's really important for the general state to understand what is being planted in the state. And to be honest, even for me, I mean, I moved to Australia 7 years ago, and I was I know all the region around Melbourne pretty well. But even looking at the state view, like the bird's eye view, and see how much farming is going on in northwest of Victoria is quite amazing to me. Actually, I had really no idea. And getting a picture of everything that's being planted, and for example, I didn't realize how much legumes we have in Victoria, you know, like from peas, beans, chickpeas, fava beans, lentils. I just find it quite amazing.
Mm. And then I guess you can use that data as well for things like, does it go so far as you can try and determine things like yield estimates through it?
Yeah, so that would be actually, there's two parts to it. There's the data, which is the new satellite data, which maybe I can talk a bit about, and I think it would be very useful for this. And there is the product that we developed with this data, which is the land cover map. But it's true that for agriculture, so basically this data is satellite images that are taken by a relatively new European space program called Sentinel-2. And what this program does, so you can imagine you have satellites that are orbiting at 800 kilometers away from Earth, and they're taking one picture of the full Earth every 5 days at 10 meter resolution and for free. So that's really been a game changer, because you can imagine that agricultures could use this data, and maybe there's crops that they cannot go to because they're too far or they don't have the time. And for free, the data is available every 5 days to tell them about how the crop is growing, basically. And so, yes, we're hoping to get to yield estimation in the future. The first step was to get to the vegetation type, and there's a lot of use for fire and flood management, etc. But, yeah, we're hoping we can get to yield estimate and maybe disease outbreak detection a bit earlier and this kind of applications.
And so what, before this round of, I guess, this latest development of technology was available, what was the previous option? I gather it was much lower resolution. And did you get the information less often?
Yes, exactly. So the map that people had developed, the government had developed for Australia, was at 50 meter resolution. So it means that it's 25 times coarser than what we're doing, right? Instead of having 10 by 10 meter, you have 50 by 50 meters. So that's very, very different, because, for example, you will not see all of the little lines of trees, you know, like, for example, you will not see the roads, you will not see the trees that are growing along the roads, and that, for example, extremely important for fire modeling. So that's for the map, but also for the satellite. So before Sentinel-2, we had the American Landsat program, and Landsat program was taking one picture of Earth for free as well, but at 30 meter resolution and every 10 to 15 days. So we're going down from 30 meters at 15 days to 10 meters at 5 days, and that's massive difference.
And just finally, you've done this for Victoria. Could it be replicated easily to other states? Is that part of the idea, or would that be a lot of work to get it happening in other states?
Yeah, so that's basically what I'm hoping for. So I'm a researcher, so basically this map was a prototype here to show that we can actually do it. And the data is all available, and the way the map is created is by feeding the satellite data to an algorithm that learns what vines or canola crops look like this particular year. And so the only thing that's missing to be able to do that everywhere, apart from having big hard drives, but that's not really an issue, is to have examples of the different crops. So you can imagine that to create this map, we actually used the data from the V. Lewis team at Agriculture Victoria. And what they do is every year they go out to the field and they drive around for 4 or 5 weeks and they say, okay, this is barley, this is wheat, this is oats, this is canola. And then they report back all this data on a map, and that's what we feed the our what we call the machine learning algorithm to learn what the different types of crops look like this particular year. Because, I mean, agriculturists know very well that from one year to another, the growth might be very different.
That's Francois Petitjean from Monash, who says this new online map could make a big difference. Well, a few more of your rainfall figures trickling through to 0467 922 783. Jeff at Virginia has picked up 7 millimetres. Thanks, Jeff. Over in the Riverland and Pike River has had 10 mils. And Steve at Tarawi, 11 millimetres. Year to date is 134 millimetres. We rely on tank water, no mains. Thanks for your text, Steve. You can let us know how much rain you've had. 0467 922 783.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Where it is 25 past 12. Well, a farming family from Lock in South Australia has continued its relationship with a prestigious ag college in France, welcoming their ninth French student to the region. Jamie and Anne Sivier have the students stay on their farm to learn about farming in Australia, but to also help improve their English skills. Brooke Neindorf caught up with Jamie and their newest visitor, Quinton, to talk about the student exchange.
So all of the French students that we've had have come from the Perpin Agricultural College in Toulouse in France, and I had the opportunity of working on a farm near Lyon, and we were contacted by that farmer's cousin's son to see if he could come to a farm here in Australia. So that's where the association started with the college over there, and they come out here and they experience farm life in Australia, and they have to go to an English-speaking country at the end of their second year to improve their English.
How long have you been involved with this?
I think the first one we had was in 2007.
So more than 10 years now.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So at first we didn't have them every year. We had them every second year, but recently we've been having them every year. So Quinton's the ninth one that we've had.
So you said they get to experience farm life here in Australia. What do you get them to do?
So they arrive at the end of June and they leave basically the end of September. So they miss out on seeding and harvest, but because we have sheep, they experience shearing and pasture spraying, crop spraying, and then, of course, they also experience the social part of living in the country as well.
And that takes takes in the local footy scene as well?
Oh, yes, they all have a chance of playing footy for the Lockroos, and yeah, it's a different experience. Some of them have had a soccer background, some have had a rugby background. The rugby players make a better transition into football than the soccer players, but yeah, and we take them to the Adelaide show and of course to a Crows match and show them around the country as well.
Why did you want to get involved with something like this?
I guess I've always believed in giving back, and I had the experience of working on the farm near Lyon, like I said, and so we sort of repaid that by hosting the first student, and then the association with the college over there just continued, and 2 years ago Anne and I went back over to France again, and we went to the college and they gave us a tour of the college and the facilities there, and we actually got to meet all of the past students that we've had, which was a fantastic experience for us.
What do you think the students get out of coming here to the region of Lock?
I hope they get to experience, you know, Australian farm life and Australian culture, and it greatly improves their English because they're doing a 5-year agricultural engineering degree, and they could pass all their other subjects with flying colours, but if they don't pass a very rigorous English exam when they go back, they can't pass their degree. So it's very important that they complete their English, because the French government recognises that English is the world language for the economy and for agriculture. So it's a very important part. So we help them as much as we can. Of course, they don't go back just speaking English. They speak a bit of Australian thrown in there as well. And if you're out in the sheepyard, he learns a few other words as well.
And what do you think is the biggest difference that they see coming from France to Australia in terms of their farming practices?
Well, that is one of the interesting things. And they've all come from different backgrounds. So they haven't all been off of farms. One lad Both of his parents were professional musicians for the Bordeaux Orchestra. Most are off farms, from dairies. The last one we had was off of a sheep dairy. Quinton's off of a cropping farm, so we can compare a lot of things. But he's probably realising now that we don't have a lot of rain and that our soils are, even our heavy soils, are sandy compared with their soils. And so we've been showing him the difference between our heavy soils and our sandy soils.
Quinton, we might come to you now. And what was your first thought when you arrived here at Locke?
I was thinking my English before because it's difficult to understand and speak with Jamie or this family. And after, the landscape is very different. It's very flat, but it's the paddock is very biggest and the sheep is very... I don't have the sheep in the farm at my father, so it's very different, yeah.
Jamie and Anne had you tasting Vegemite when you first arrived. Can you tell us what that was like?
No, it's not for me. I think it's not for the French students all, but yeah, it's important to test and, yeah, test the culture.
What are you looking forward to most about being here in the Locke region?
For the football, because it's your sport. For me, the football is soccer, but for you, it's other sports. So, yeah, I training the last week. Yeah, it's my first training last week. So, yeah, we try.
Hope he had fun and he's picked the right AFL team to support. Red and white colours, anyway. No, that's probably not a popular opinion in South Australia. That's French ag student Quinton, who is staying with Jamie and Anne Sivier in Locke, speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. It is just after 12:30, so let's find out what's making news headlines. It's good afternoon to Luke Radford.
Good afternoon, Isabella. The Civil Aviation Safety Authority has cleared the carrier Regional Express of allegations that it has a poor safety culture. CASA was investigating concerns raised by a former employee over the Regional Services aircraft maintenance. The audit came last week at the same time a video emerged which claimed to show a rusty propeller shaft on one of its planes during a flight in South Australia. But Rex says it was muck on a piece of metal on an engine which was subsequently wiped off. The Port Augusta City Council wants to install lighting at the local airport so it can be used at night. The council has approached the state government for funding to incorporate navigation and landing lights. Mayor Brett Benbow says expanding the airport's operations to nighttime flying would open the door to fly-in, fly-out workers being based in Port Augusta. And massive crowds of spectators have descended on the remote outback town of Maree over the weekend for the annual Camel Cup. The Maree Camel Race was the first of its kind in Australia, and this year's race drew the largest crowd in the event's history. Local publican Phil Turner says there's no sport quite like camel racing. And we'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Luke. Let's a few more of your rainfall texts coming through. 20467 922 783. There's 8 mils at Ululu, and Brendan has texted in to say 7.8 millimeters in Berry. Thanks for that, Brendan. And at Berry North as well. Thanks, Brendan. And another one here, 30 millimetres over the weekend here at Mount Benson. That's from Tony on the tractor. Thanks, Tony. Quite a bit of rain there. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now and say good afternoon to senior forecaster Paul Bierman, because there is more rain on the radar. Hi, Paul.
Good afternoon, Isabella.
There's more to come.
Yeah, that is right. We do have a system moving through the middle of this week, which is going to bring us some rain and showers to the agricultural parts of the state. But first of all, today we did see quite extensive areas of fog around some parts this morning, particularly around central parts of Eyre Peninsula, and well, that is probably cleared away now. We are expecting further fog to develop late this evening and continue into Tuesday morning as well, so another foggy day tomorrow. And for today, we have seen some showers about the south today, some showers around Adelaide and the Mount Lofty ranges already, but we have seen showers on the radar around the southeast district as well. So we are seeing those isolated showers, mainly about that southern agricultural area, mostly about the Mount Lofty ranges and the southeast districts. And otherwise, we are looking at sunny conditions across the north of the state, but partly cloudy in the south, but generally light winds, but tending moderate westerly in the south. Maximum temperatures today ranging from around 13 degrees at Clare up to 22 degrees up at Moomba in the far north. And a similar day tomorrow as well. We're likely to see areas of fog about agricultural parts of the state and possibly also the southern pastoral districts. a cold morning with areas of frost possible over the northern agricultural areas, but more likely over those pastoral districts and the Flinders Ranges. Slight to medium chance of showers about the southern agricultural area, but most likely about Kangaroo Island and the lower southeast, as winds tend a bit northwesterly through the morning ahead of the next changes, which is expected during Wednesday. So a touch warmer conditions on Tuesday, but then with this front coming through on Wednesday, we're seeing much cooler, wetter and windier conditions to be expected from Wednesday onwards and continuing into Thursday and Friday as well. So we are forecasting showers right across the agricultural areas. Heavier falls will be, as we typically see, across the southern agricultural areas and the Mount Lofty Ranges. That'll probably tend to rain at times with the front moving through, so areas could in the south could see a period of steady rain through the middle of the day, early afternoon on Wednesday. There's even the chance we could get some thunderstorms and even some showers of small hail in the south. That's probably most likely about Kangaroo Island and the Fleury Peninsula and the southeast districts. That's most likely later on Wednesday and continuing into Thursday morning as well. And it's going to be quite a windy period as well, particularly so during Wednesday. So we're likely to see warnings issued for all coastal waters locations on Wednesday, and also the potential for some damaging winds over land as well. Most likely will be coastal parts of the southern agricultural area, but also the Mount Lofty Ranges, possibly extending into the mid-north as well. And this system's also going to bring up quite a significant swell as well. So we're going to see windy conditions over the waters and sort of increased swell as well. No showers likely to continue across the agricultural areas later on in the week, but easing towards the weekend, particularly sort of in the west as a high pressure ridge comes in during Saturday and Sunday, but showers continuing across the southern agricultural area. In terms of rainfall amounts, for the most part, expecting rainfall to be in the order of 10 to 20 millimetres across the southern agricultural area, but areas of the Mount Lofty Ranges in the southeast likely to see in the range of 20 to 30 millimetres. Isolated locations within the Mount Lofty Ranges and the lower southeast could get rainfall as much as 30 to even 50 millimetres. And the wettest day with this week is going to be Wednesday, but with the showers continuing across those areas for a few days to follow, and we'd like to see the gradual accumulation over a few days. But across the north, no rainfall is expected in the far north of the state, and only sort of getting up to the order of 5, potentially 10 millimetres across those northern agricultural areas. So there we go. Isabella, I hope that brings you up to date with the weather
today. Yeah, Paul, it sounds like there's a lot for you to keep an eye on this week.
Oh yeah, it's a bit to watch out for. It's good to see some rainfall at this time of the year. It's when we sort of need the rainfall the most, I guess, in those agricultural areas. So it's good that we're seeing these regular fronts coming through and bringing increased rainfall at times.
Yeah, just a shame more of it isn't getting to the north of the state.
Yeah, it would be good to see that rainfall extend a little bit further north, but for those sort of, across the north, perhaps have to wait till next week.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
That's Paul Bierman there at the Weather Bureau. Let's look to the far west of New South Wales now. A mostly sunny day with patches of light morning frost in the southwest. Overnight temperatures falling to between 3 and 8, with daytime temperatures reaching between 16 and 19. For the lower western district, a mostly sunny day with patchy fog and frost in the north in the morning. Then overnight temperatures falling to around 3, with daytime temperatures reaching between 15 and 18 degrees. A few more of your rainfall texts, 20467 922 783. Tim from Francis says we've had 15 millimetres yesterday and another 2 this morning. Thanks for that, Tim. And over to Mount Gambier, a text here saying we've had 14 millimetres of rain over the weekend. The beautiful green grass of home. Very happy. Love sitting under that old oak tree. Thanks for that slightly poetic text there. And Martin says, "G'day, Isabella. To be fair, I think even no rain would be better than a kick in the teeth." Now, look, Martin, when I read that literally, you're probably right, but it's all about perspective with the rainfall figures, I think. But thanks for having your say, Martin. You can get in touch on 0467 922 783.
The ABC. Celebrating the UN Year of Indigenous Languages.
Hello, my name is Alberta Hornsby. I'm a person of many cultural heritages, Kuku Yimitha, Yidinji, Gangalida and Ankamuthi. Did you know that the name of the Endeavour River in Cooktown was originally Walumbal Biri? It's named Endeavour when Captain Cook came to repair his ship.
Find more place name stories at abc.net.au/thisplace.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
Where it is 20 to 1 and my name's Isabella Pittaway. Animal rights group Vegan Rising says the federal government's new trespass bill is threatening their right to take action against animal cruelty on farms. The bill would create two new offences for activists that incite people to trespass, damage or steal from agricultural land. Kristen Lee, the founder of Vegan Rising, told David Claughton the government is attempting to suppress what's happening in agriculture.
I think it's a classic example of the government trying to hide the truth of what's really going on in this country in the treatment of animals and trying to keep that disconnect of people's choices at the supermarket so that they keep being dumbed down consumers who are unaware of what's really going on. So our aims are to show the truth so that we can help make change and help make people make choices that are actually in line with their values. So,
but it could result, if this passes, in you going to jail if you transmit something, broadcast something, distribute something with the intent to incite someone to trespass on agricultural land.
Yes, right. So what that actually means is if someone sees an animal being, you know, beaten over the head as little piglets are in sheds all across this country as legal standard practice, and if someone is horrified by that and shares that, and then someone else goes along and thinks, that's horrible, I'm going to go and try and expose that further, then yeah, they could go to jail for that. So we've got to start asking ourselves.
So you could publish about it, but you wouldn't be able to incite someone to trespass.
But where does that line get drawn? If you publish something and it upsets someone to a point where they want to take action against it by going and discovering what's going on themselves, how do we know that they're not going to then say that you've incited someone by sharing that footage? Where are they going to draw that line?
As long as you, when you make your Facebook post or publish it in another platform, don't say, we encourage you to go and trespass on agricultural land, I guess you're okay. People will make their own
judgments. Well, who knows? And I guess, you know, people have got to ask, do they want to know the truth? Do they want to support a government that wants to hide the truth of what's really going on? Or do they want to support a government that wants a kind world where we treat the vulnerable beings that we live amongst with respect?
Although there's a difference, isn't there, between activists who might trespass on land to rescue an animal or capture vision and those who might unlawfully damage or destroy property or commit theft. So there are degrees.
Absolutely.
Here, and if someone does that, they could go to jail for 5 years.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I think most people are aware, animal rights activists aren't damaging property, and we don't consider rescuing an animal from being harmed theft. So there's rescue and there's theft, and animals aren't property. Therefore, rescuing them from a life of enslavement and torture and death is not theft. They're
sorry,
a living being.
Can I go back on that?
In
what sense do you mean they're not property if they are owned by the farmer?
Well, they're living. Well, they can't be owned by the farmer in the same way that you can't own a child or an elderly person. They're vulnerable beings, and we have a responsibility to protect them. But it doesn't mean we own them. Under the law, they are, and that law needs to change.
There is one other change to the Criminal Code, Agricultural Protection Bill, which is ensuring that whistleblowers still have the ability to operate and that journalists are protected when they report on animal welfare issues. So in a way that used to be before animal welfare groups started taking things into their own hands, the way that the public's right to know was satisfied. Would you be satisfied with those provisions that protect whistleblowers and journalists?
So journalists could actually go inside these properties and expose what's going on and be protected. I don't think that's what they're saying. I think that's what they're saying is if a journalist reports on something that they heard or managed to witness from the, you know, outside a fence line or something, then they might be protected. But look, the reality is these things are happening behind high walls and behind locked doors. So journalists aren't going to be able to really get this information if it wasn't for the people that were risking their own safety. They're the ones that are at risk, and the animals are the ones that are terrorised. No one else is doing any terror here except the people that are raising those animals and killing them. So I think, yeah, that's great. Journalists absolutely deserve protection from reporting the truth, but so do individuals who are just trying to make a better world for everyone.
That's Kristen Lee, the founder of Vegan Rising, which was the group that disrupted Melbourne's streets back in April. She was speaking there to David Claughton about this new trespass bill that the federal government is looking to introduce. More rainfall texts to 0467 922 783. Ian up at Port Pirie had 0.4 of a millimetre, and Ian says that he's hoping for more on Wednesday. Harry has had 8.5 millimetres in Peterborough. Thanks for your text, Harry. And another text here saying 5 mils over the weekend and plenty of beers to match. That's from Frog from Coongawa. Hope I got the pronunciation right there. Frog, thanks for your text. You can have your say on 0467 922 783. Well, you may recall last week we talked about a major shake-up for the red meat industry. The Red Meat Advisory Council released a white paper recommending that research, development and advocacy be under the control of one single body. This is some of what the council's chairman, Don Mackay, had to say last week.
The formation of a substantial entity nominally called Red Meat Australia, which will be the organisation that receives the levy funds from all of industry, and it will then apportion those funds back to the various organisations that will use those levies for research and development, for marketing, for maintenance of our integrity systems. This system will provide an organisation that gives clear line of sight for the levy payers. So if you're a producer, you're paying levies, those levies go into an organisation in which you have a direct influence, and that organisation will also have the capacity to develop policy and advocate that policy.
That's Don Mackay from the Red Meat Advisory Council. Sheep Producers Australia has welcomed the white paper. I spoke to Chairman Chris Myrams, who says it's a 1-in-20-year chance to streamline services and break down silos.
Yes, it is a radical change. And industry's asked for a bold and visionary review. And that's exactly what we've got. We've got a bold and visionary response in the white paper.
Where do you currently see areas of duplication? Because that's something you've noted in your response.
The areas of duplication in my mind is that there are just too many institutions within the environment now. And they've grown and done a fantastic job in the past. However, going forwards, wherever there's just so many institutions that each one support staff and governance and expenses, that if we could streamline that, and that's in the plan, then that'd be a good thing.
Where do you think are some of those areas that need to be streamlined?
Well, for instance, in the RDC world, there are three RDCs, Research and Development Corporations, that work in the red meat industry. There's the MLA, there's AMPC and LiveCorp, and they all do joint ventures together. And as we're heading into the future with lots of challenges and opportunities in a rapidly changing world, we take the view that working across the whole of supply chain will be much more efficient and beneficial than working in silos.
What are your thoughts on the grey area, and that is the merging of advocacy and lobbying and compulsory levies going towards that?
Well, that's a really great question. So at the moment, levy funding is not able to be used for political advocacy. And I get that. I would argue that for Peak Industry Council's advocacy on strategic issues and on policy is quite separate from political advocacy and that it's quite a good use of levy payers' funds. But I understand from the government's perspective that they don't want to pay people to come in and tell them what to do from Peak Industry Council's. But having said that, if we could separate the political advocacy from actually advocating on behalf of industry on policy, then that would be a good step forward.
But do you have concerns that compulsory levies would be going towards a lobbying government?
Under the new MOU, that's not likely to happen. No, that the legislation is quite clear, and we'd make sure that doesn't happen.
Critics have already described this as an attempt by the old guard to hijack producer levies and keep control of what they say is the rudder. What do you say to those concerns about this change?
Well, I would say that wherever there's expenditure through levies, that there has to be a really sound governance structure and some strategic direction given to how those levies are spent. And so I guess whatever structure you set up, there'll be critics. But that's what industry needs. It needs sound governance, high-level strategic thinking to plan where those levies go and the matching funds, and that's what this that's what we currently have in a revised MOU would do an even better job.
Chris, what do you think this will mean for sheep producers? Do you see benefits for them?
Yes. Well, there are a number of benefits. We're moving into an environment, I think, Isabella, of rapid change. Our customers are changing, the world's changing, market access is changing. We really need to keep abreast of it and be thinking really at a high level as to how we're going to move forwards. Sheep producers have got a fantastic future, but there are lots of challenges, lots of choices for our customers, and our customers are getting to be extremely demanding, I guess is the word, and informed is probably a kinder word. And so we have great opportunities, but great challenges too. I think a new MOU and the restructures will provide more efficiency, less duplication, as we said, some more targeted application of levy funds, and I think it's a good thing. We fully support lifting the bonnet and having a good look underneath and seeing where we can make some improvements. It's a one in 20 year opportunity, I think.
That's Sheep Producers Australia Chairman Chris Myrams. Well, on the text line 0467 922 783, an anonymous text has criticised Vegan Rising founder Kristen Lee, saying that she needs to read the biosecurity signs at some farmers' gates. That is, of course, referring to comments on the new trespass bill that the federal government is looking to introduce. Thank you for your thoughts on that one. And on rainfall, Mary from Mount Gambier has picked up 15 millimetres in the rain gauge over the weekend and says it's lovely for our garden. Indeed it is. Thanks for your text, Mary. 0467 922 783 if you have any more rainfall figures to share. The definition of lamb has changed, and one producer reckons that could mean tastier meat. From this month, a lamb is defined as able to cut one or both of its permanent central incisor teeth and still be called a lamb, as long as the teeth are not in wear. That means they may be slightly older than the lamb you've been buying. Ben Sipple sells his saltbush lamb at farmers' markets in New South Wales, and he told David Claughton some people reckon the flavour is better.
I think there's very little difference with a slightly older animal, and a lot of people from the country do actually prefer that two-tooth flavour. And if you can pick the difference, you know, if you know the age of an animal by checking its teeth, well, I'd like you to find that out once its head comes off, that how are you able to actually do that?
So. And what is it about a two-tooth animal that people like in terms of eating?
I think it's just got a little bit more character to the meat and a better eating characteristic. Not so much a very underdeveloped sort of suckling flavour. And you do get that bigger size in the muscle. So your cutlet, for example, will be a much more decently sized cutlet compared to that of a 6-month-old lamb, potentially.
A bigger cut, a better taste, potentially. But would it be as tender?
Well, tenderness, that's the ultimate challenge because, you know, if you poke something with a electric prodder before it gets slaughtered, you're going something that's quite tough and chewy and horrible. And we're finding that, especially with our work with the saltbush-fed lamb, that it's still, because of that great, fantastic, high-mineral diet that they are on, it's producing beautiful, tender, succulent meat and very moist.
So you think the way that an animal is slaughtered actually is more important in terms of tenderness than actually its age?
That's a big contributing factor to it, is stress before slaughter, yes, and that pH factor that goes through the animal before it, as it's setting. Animals with a low pH, will be a bit tougher than ones with a higher pH, and stress is a big factor in that.
So a good news day for lamb producers.
I feel so, yes. I think it's a good progressive step in the right direction. The Kiwis had it right for ages, and it's good to see us catching up.
That's lamb producer Ben Sipple. And Josh at Kutra has been hanging out with Frog and said, I had plenty of beers with Frog, but I got 6.5 millimetres. So Kutra doing a bit better than Coongawa. So thanks for your text there, Josh. 0467 922 783 is the number. Well, the Regenerative Agricultural Alliance is calling on organisations to pitch ideas for new innovative Regen Ag projects. And the Alliance, which is based in New South Wales, is offering to match the research investment dollar for dollar. It's now opened round two after receiving more than 40 applications for its initial round. The director of the Alliance, Lorraine Gordon, is speaking here to Kim Honan.
So what we're looking for is projects based on ecology. So we're not necessarily after ag tech type projects, but projects that can actually advance the cause of regenerative agriculture. So alternative solutions to, say, mainstream herbicides and pesticides, new cultivars, all sorts of different areas that can assist farmers to farm, I guess, in a different manner to be able to be resilient with climate change and drought.
So who can apply?
Anybody can apply, and we can actually match their funds. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean a lot of money to be able to do that, but we can actually, in some cases, even triple those funds to do some really good research, solid research that is industry applicable and can be taken up to, you know, really end up with a better future for ourselves.
How much funding do you have available then?
As much funding as industry can put in, we can match. So it's unlimited, really. But we really wanted to kick off with, you know, three really strong projects. So it's about matching our researchers with industry to be able to capitalise on those opportunities.
And have you had any interest so far?
We have had a lot of interest in all sorts of areas, whether it be, you know, livestock production or horticulture or arable cropping. It's coming from different angles, which is great.
If anyone is interested, they've just got to put in a 100-word pitch initially?
Yeah, very simple. We're not into lots of paperwork, so it's a 100-word pitch, and then we can just make that phone call and take it from there. So easy process, and no idea is a stupid idea. You know, we like to hear new thoughts, and it can be anything, really, and we just take it from there.
How do you then go about selecting those successful three projects?
A lot of those applications will be gone through to have a look at what capacity we have in different research areas. So it's matching our expertise with industry. So that's quite critical. And there are certain spaces I think have a sense of urgency about them, and particularly when we're looking at, you know, high levels of chemical use like we're seeing now and the effects on our food and our health. I mean, that's a really interesting space. We're also working very solidly in the natural capital accounting space. So trying to put a value on the environment and what shelter belts and clean water and increasing soil carbon, what that actually means to the bottom line and to the balance sheet for landscapes and for farms. So that's a really interesting space at the moment. But really, it can be any idea that industry has or something that industry wants to test with some really good scientific rigour behind it. So, like I said, no idea is a stupid idea.
So how many farmers involved with Regen Ag actually use natural capital accounting? Is it a fairly new area?
This is a very new area. Internationally, not so much, but in Australia it is. There's been some fantastic conversations only last week in Brisbane. So we've got the likes of Climate Works working very solidly in the space. I know the Wentworth group of scientists have done some fantastic work, as has CSIRO. So it's about trying to bring all of those minds together and agree on a set of standards that we can take forward.
That's Lorraine Gordon from the Regenerative Agricultural Alliance. And here's John Traeger now at the Dublin Cattle Market.
Good afternoon. Numbers remain steady as agents offered 150 lightweight cattle and 125 open auction calves to a good field of trade and restocker buyers. Quality was again extremely mixed, with a large percentage of the market comprising of pastoral bred steers and heifers from the Oodnadatta area. The few vealer steers on offer were keenly sought after to sell from 230 to 322 cents, with heifers also strongly contested and receiving 270 to 330 cents. Yearling steers went mainly to restockers at rates from 264 to 292 cents, with C3 descriptions selling from 302 to 330 cents. Yearling heifers were again mostly pastoral bred, with rates varying widely from $1 to 260 cents, with a single C3 heifer receiving 282 cents. Grown pastoral steers sold from 170 to 240 cents to be firm. Cow numbers were also down, with rates varying from 154 to 210 cents, with these being firm for type and condition.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.